Welcome to the I Hate Critics Movie Review Podcast. I'm professional film critic Sean Patrick. With me is Jeff.
How's it going?
Jeff, where can people find your art?
JeffLasser.com is my website, as always. I kind of moved all my stuff over to my Instagram, which is Jeff Lasseter Pop Cult. Kind of going from there with... instead of my personal one, which has just kind of lately been bombarded with douchebags. Jeff Lasseter Pop Cult is my Instagram. If you want to see in progress stuff right now, I'm working on a Phantom Menace piece that I hope to have done by the 16th.
Is it new sexy Jar Jar?
No, sexy Jar Jar is still there. Trust me. Jar Jar is in this one, but it's a little different. It's a little closer to the stuff I've been doing over the last few months with like some of my Friday the 13th pieces. And So, yeah, I'm hoping it turns out well. I've got R2-D2 done tonight. So
very cool.
We'll go from there.
Very cool. And of course, we'll be talking about the Phantom Menace later on in the show. Of course, we're on Facebook, facebook.com and Critics Pod on Twitter. I won't call it the other thing. Instagram as well. And anywhere where you listen to podcasts, of course, you're already listening to the show. Why do I mention that? I don't know. Bob used to. did you see today's Twitter main character, Jeff?
I have not really paid attention to Twitter today.
So the Twitter main character today, James Gunn released a photo of Superman, David Cornsweet, the first image we've had of Superman. And it's an image that kind of people were looking at kind of funny. Like it almost looked like it was AI generated until like James Gunn confirmed, yeah. No, this was in camera. Like this is an in camera photo because it looked a little strange. It's a picture of Superman. He's putting his boots on. In the background, you can see like something's attacking Earth or whatever. And so somebody, and I'm not going to give them any clout by mentioning who they are. They posted this thing that said, "I know why people are having trouble with this image. It's because that pose is effeminate."
Do men not put their fucking cowboy boots on like that? What the fuck?
I kid you not, this is
telling on themselves.
I kid you not, this person posted this and said this pose is effeminate. That's why people are struggling with it. It's like nobody's really struggling with it. They're just like, oh, that's interesting. My thing is like I was kind of taken aback by it because like why is Superman putting on his boots? Like doesn't he just have super speed? He just, you know, he just ducks into a phone booth, he changes his clothes immediately. He's already got the boots on. Like he goes and then he goes and fights crime. Like I just imagine Superman sitting down and like somebody's attacking Earth. He's like, hang on, I got to put my boots on.
That's what I saw was that, you know, my thing was, oh, by all means, move at a glacial pace. You know how that thrills me. But no, I haven't seen anything.
But yeah, this person was just basically dunked on all day for this take that somebody putting on boots is effeminate. I responded to one tweet thread by saying that they asked, "Does it make you a girl if you put on your boots?" And I'm like, "Yes, it does. I prefer to leap into my shoes. It takes a couple of tries, but you know, if I don't look like a girl."
I don't wear a lot of boots, but
has this person never heard of shoes with laces either? Like one of the, I think most people have to sit down when they put those on. If you don't, good for you. I mean, they do have shoes you can just step into. That's not necessarily feminine or masculine in any way, though.
Yeah.
What a bizarre take.
Maybe, you know what? Maybe it's somebody who works for, one of the shoe companies that make the ones you can just step into and they look like they're all laced up. This is
propaganda for the step-in shoe. Big step-in shoe is coming through in this tweet. I checked in on this person's Twitter feed, and I was just going through it, they would not give up on this take. No matter how many times they got dunked on, they would not let it go. I was just kind of shocked at the willingness that they had to continuously be dunked on and just continue to try and double down and explain themselves. Which in the end, they kind of came around to the point that I was making, and it's kind of weird just to see Superman putting on his boots, which, yeah, it is kind of weird because he's got, you know, we've never seen that before. We've never seen Superman have to pause to put his suit on. I don't think we've ever seen that, right?
Yeah, I'm looking at the photo now, and I guess I can see what, you know, I see what they're trying to do. Like, you know what, we're getting ready for Superman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, David Cornsweet is getting ready for Superman.
Right.
I get that. That's what I get from it. But I don't get, oh, look at me, I'm a little poof to put on my boots while I'm, you know, aren't I effeminate? No. What the fuck?
I responded to another tweet thread on this photo talking about, you know, because I made the mention of how I think it's weird that we're watching Superman put his boots on. And I said, and somebody said, well, you know, he's Superman. He, you know, like everybody else, he puts his boots on one at a time. And I said, the Everyman of Steel.
The one reply I liked to the photo was missed opportunity. And it's the big red cartoon boots. I don't know. I just thought it was funny.
This person is amazing to me that this is the take that they took away from this. That this is an effeminate pose. He's just putting on boots.
I'm at a loss for words because that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And I've heard a lot of stupid things lately. I've been following the news a lot. So, yeah.
Truly, just truly an epic take. And they, of course, yes, like I said, they were Twitter's main character today.
Ugh.
They're probably like, I don't know. Again, I'm not going to give them clout by mentioning who they are. Maybe they're a Snyder bro. Maybe they're just looking for anything. Just reaching for anything to criticize about James Gunn's Superman. As we speak right now, hashtag fire James Gunn is trending on Twitter because it always does about, you know, anytime something Superman related is mentioned.
I am just like the utter toxicity of fandoms. And we can get into this topic a little more when we start talking about the Phantom Menace.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, do you not enjoy the stuff you purport to enjoy? Or do you have a humiliation kink? Because what's going on? You know? Yeah, we'll talk about that. Let's talk about that when we talk about a Phantom Menace. Because the revisionist history around the prequels is killing me lately. So anyway.
So true. And I do want to bring that conversation back around a little later on. But first, we're going to get the movies that one of us saw out of the way. How about that? Saw the movie Jean de Berry, starring Johnny Depp, directed by a woman named Mai Wen, who I believe either is or was married to Luc Besson. Not mentioning reasons. She didn't get this movie made, because, at least thus far. No, she's a filmmaker herself. She's made this movie about the legendary courtesan Jean de Berry, who was the mistress of King Louis XV. And interesting story, but just not particularly well executed. The lack of chemistry between Mai Wen and Johnny Depp is pretty obvious. He's doing a pretty strong French accent. And he's an interesting choice to play the king, but it's the most like mannered and kind of stiff Johnny Depp we've ever seen. I'm not sure what his choice to play this character was. I don't sense any kind of passion or excitement coming from him at all. She's trying, you know, she's putting everything in, and it's hard work on her part. She's directing, writing, and starring in this film, and he's pretty much just giving her nothing throughout the entire movie, and it leaves just kind of this kind of interesting story that really doesn't have a point. That just kind of happens in front of you and then it's over. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I missed that.
The sets are pretty spectacular. She's got a great eye. The cinematography is not bad considering, you know, she's trying to go as period specific as possible and make it look of the period as much as possible. And I can certainly appreciate that. But when you don't have the chemistry and the co-star to make that, you know, this story of lifetime of a lifetime's worth of passion in a short amount of time work. And it just feels like a big waste of time.
Yeah.
And it's one of those movies, you know, there's this big debate about are movies too long today is like another thing that's been trending lately. And
yeah.
And I always come back. I can't remember who said it, but it's the best line about this is that no good movie is too long and no bad movie is too short.
Yep.
And, you know, it just comes down to pacing. If your movie is paced well, people will enjoy it no matter how long it is.
I agree with that. I think that I've said several times on the show that, you know, this movie is too long, or, you know, I could use a whole series of this. And usually for me, a whole series means that I find it to be a compliment. I want it to be longer and more in depth. But I was actually thinking about that with The Fall Guy and the number of climaxes that movie has. Mm-hmm. And for me, some movies that we've seen lately, it's not that they're too long. It's just that they have too many climaxes. And maybe that's it. Maybe that's, you know, the problem that people have with quote unquote long movies is that in order to make something long, you sometimes have to have, instead of one big climax, there's three. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Argyle. In particular.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that movie had like four climaxes and it just needed one. And then, you know, like a stinger, but it had so many climaxes. So
you saw something that I didn't see.
Oh yes. I saw the movie Femme. It's streaming now. It's not, it was not released in theaters or anything. I saw it on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. It stars George MacKay and Nathan Stewart Jarrett. Nathan Stewart Jarrett plays Jules, who is a drag performer who is performing one night, goes out back, and he is kind of, you know, looked at by this guy played by George MacKay. And then later on goes to a convenience store and kind of talks shit back to Preston, played by George MacKay, and his friends who are giving him a hard time about being gay and dressed as a woman. Mm-hmm. They follow him outside and attack him and beat him within an inch of his life. 3 months later, Jules is still kind of laying low at home. He doesn't want to go out, doesn't want to perform anymore. But one night he's just like, I can't do this anymore. I got to get out. So instead he goes to a gay bathhouse where he runs into Preston, and Preston is being really aggressive towards a guy who's trying to, you know, like fuck him basically. Jules follows Preston and he's like, just can't believe it. And then they end up actually hooking up. This leads to a months-long affair where Preston doesn't want any of his friends to know that he's gay or that he's hooking up with somebody. Jules is introduced as his mate. You know, they're just buddies and he buys drugs from him sometimes. And as they're like growing closer, Jules is trying to get revenge. He keeps trying to record their sex to expose Preston to the world on this revenge porn site. Mm-hmm. But they develop feelings for each other and I guess love. They love each other by, you know, by the end of the movie. And when it all comes out, they basically beat the shit out of each other, and you're kind of left I was sympathizing with Preston at the end of the movie, and I don't know if that's just because George MacKay is so like such a good performer. You know, at the beginning, you're with Jules 100% because he's the one who gets attacked, and you know he's the one who is having a hard time. But then George MacKay makes Preston so human, and you know the fact that he and his friends beat the shit out of Jules was basically him repressing his desire, and it's left a little bit resolved at the end, but. As the tables are a little bit turned, it becomes really, really interesting, but it does have its moments of, it stretches credulity a little bit in spots, but overall the performances by Nathan Stewart Jarrett and George MacKay are really what kind of draws you in.
I wanted to see this so bad because of Nathan Stewart Jarrett, that he is a guy that Jeff and I talked, or that Bob and I talked about on the podcast back in 2019. He was in a movie called Mope, where he and another guy played two very, very, very low on the totem pole porn actors who just have like the worst jobs in porn, which you can only imagine. And the movie is so dark and so depressing, but he is so incredible in it. Just playing this guy who is so desperate to be a porn movie star that he'll do anything, and it goes places. It really goes places, and he is incredible in it, so that he's the reason why you wanted to see this. Unfortunately, I just did not get the chance.
It's well worth the rental. I remember him as the brother in the new Candyman movie from a couple years ago, but it did take me a little bit to put my finger on quite where I knew him, and then I looked up and I was like, of course. Yeah, so he's really good at it. Well worth seeing.
All right. Well, our next film is a bad one. It's called this movie, I have to keep looking at it to remember the title. That's how bland and boring the idea of you is. Anne Hathaway and Nicholas Galitzin starring a romantic comedy about a 40-year-old woman and a 26-year-old boy band star who fall in love. And their age gap drives the drama about whether or not they're going to be together. The fact that her daughter was a fan of his boy band and when she was younger is an obstacle. But really, there aren't that many obstacles between them, and the obstacles that the movie builds aren't very interesting. Which is surprising to me because Michael Showalter is the director here, and he's a terrific director. He directed The Big Sick, which is one of my all-time favorite movies. Mm-hmm. He directed Hello, My Name is Doris with Sally Field, which is a tremendously underrated film. I don't understand what he saw in this like One Direction fanfic that he's directing here. It's really bizarre what he actually saw. This Nicholas Galitzin is not a bad actor, but he somehow has managed to have no chemistry with one of the most beautiful and interesting women on the planet in Anne Hathaway. And she is so kind of dimmed by his sort of lack of anything that he's giving her that it just drags the whole movie down for me. I was shocked by how much I just did not care about this movie. And I was also surprised just aesthetically. This movie is so dark. Why is it so dark? Turn on the fucking light. Why is it? It's a romantic comedy. Why is this movie so dark?
There was a thread the other day that basically said, look, I'm going to need cinematographers to start actually cinematographing again, because it's not fun to watch a movie that is so dark you can't see anything in it. You want to be able to see the movie. And yeah, it was like, you're in fucking California, you're in Silver Lake. That place is bright and airy and not dark. Your art gallery should not be dark. Your house should not be dark.
Great point. Like, why would you want a dark art gallery?
You know, if that's the case, set it in Seattle.
Yeah, I don't get it. I don't get this movie.
You know what I kept thinking about when I was watching this was, I like Anne Hathaway. I don't, Nicholas Killens, he just does not do anything for me. He's like a cipher. Mm-hmm. He's like, I forgot he was in Bottoms because he was just not a, he was not a thing in Bottoms, you know?
Right. Well, and but that played into the character though, because he was an empty, he was an empty vessel of a character.
Right, but he's just, seems like he's an empty vessel of an actor. He's not great in anything. I did not see that royal wedding, or, you know, the gay royal whatever.
Was that him? I didn't see that either. So
he was the blonde one. Everybody was talking about it. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to wait because I don't want to have to like have this discourse right now, because I'm not a big romantic comedy person.
Mm-hmm.
But I also kept thinking, you know who I would have loved to see in this story? You know, starring after watching May December, Natalie Portman and Charles Melton.
I can see that.
I just kept thinking of them as more of the kind of couple with that chemistry.
Yeah.
You know, they had a chemistry, and they were, you know, roughly the same age gap as Anne Hathaway and Nicholas Glinson, but they're just so much better. I as a, you know, I, like I said, I like Anne Hathaway. I quote Devil Wears Prada almost daily, but they weren't great together.
There's just,
she was,
yeah,
fine.
Yeah, there's just nothing there. There's no chemistry. It's barely platonic, and we're supposed to be like so excited by these sex scenes, and it's just empty. The sex scenes I thought were just empty in this movie, and on top of that, you've got these just basic bitch scenes. Like early on, they do this thing where she's having her birthday party, and her friends have invited guys to come to this party to meet her because she, you know, she's single mom and whatever. And like they do that very typical romantic comedy thing where like all these guys have a very obvious flaw that they bring up about themselves. Yeah. Like one guy is going on about how his turtle is his baby. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what the fuck is this scene? Like, this scene is in every romantic comedy. Why are you doing this now? Yeah. Michael Showalter is so much better than that scene.
I kept thinking of the scene in the movie Valentine. Do you remember that movie?
It's
a horror movie from the 90s
with David Boreanaz.
Yeah, yeah. And they go on a speed dating thing, and that was done better than in this movie. it was funnier and, you know, a little snappier, and this was just kind of like, oh,
they let the guy with the turtle just go on for a while. And it's like, why?
And internally, she's choosing the bear.
And then there's a scene like, so after like the first or fifth time they've broken up in the third act, there's a moment where like she's crying that she's just ended their relationship. Smash cut to a CarMax commercial. Her ex-husband shows up to give her daughter a car, and he goes, oh, it's not her new car, it's CarMax. You know, it's like new. Yeah. It's like, oh, is that the CarMax theme? Is that their catchphrase? Like, it's just so clumsy. Then there's like the whole first act is basically a commercial for Coachella.
Yeah.
Just, was anybody trying while they fucking made this fucking movie?
No, they weren't. Is this based on like a book or something? I mean, did Colleen Hoover write this book? Because
this is based on a book. Seems like it's based on a bestseller. Okay. I thought it was based on something from Wattpad, but apparently it's apparently a best-selling novel, which the ending of the novel is different from the movie. They changed the ending of the novel for the movie. So at the end of the novel, spoiler alert, at the end of the novel, they don't get together.
Much better ending.
Much more realistic ending than let's wait 5 years and we'll see if we can get back together.
Yeah.
And then they do. What?
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just, it, none of it rang true. it just didn't seem. It was by the numbers, but mm-hmm. not cohesive. Like when you're doing a paint by numbers, at the end of it, you have a picture.
Mm-hmm.
And this was romantic comedy by the numbers, but at the end of it, you had like three different TV movies of the week. It just did. None of it was cohesive to me.
One thing, you know, I always talk about when it comes to romantic comedies, and that is that you're going to have to hit the tropes. Like there are going to be there are aspects of romantic comedy that are just inescapable. You've got two people who have amazing chemistry that are kept apart by roadblocks. That's just part of the genre. If you had them get together and they were just happy, you don't have a movie. So you're kind of locked in to certain aspects. So what the best romantic comedies do is they take those well-known aspects of romantic comedy and they just elevate them either with just hardcore sexual chemistry, like two people who just you want to watch fuck, or things like just people being very, very witty. I know I get a lot of hate for liking this, but the movie Marry Me with Owen Wilson and Jennifer Lopez, I really enjoyed. Same premise, essentially, you know, gender flipped. She's the major pop star. He's a small time teacher. He meets her at one of her concerts. They accidentally fall into a relationship and fall in love. But it's so different tonally than every other romantic comedy because Owen Wilson is not who you would imagine would be with Jennifer Lopez. It doesn't seem like this should work. And yet I was laughing and smiling the entire time watching them try and make this happen. And it's almost just kind of ballsy just for what they were trying to do with these two actors. It has a totally different energy. And this one has no energy.
This is like, remember Notting Hill?
Yeah.
This is Nothing Hill. Wait, is that the title of our episode? Nothing Hill. They just didn't have any chemistry like Owen Wilson and Jennifer Lopez, or you know, Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts, who I didn't think, you know, were great together, but they still had a better chemistry than these two.
Yeah, I mean, well, and Richard Curtis, you know, knows how to play the notes better. He can, you know, he's wittier, he's quicker.
Yeah.
He, you know, he's got, how good are your roadblocks? What are your roadblocks? Like this one, the roadblock is, oh, I'm 16 years older than he is. I'm, you know, I could be his older sister. And my daughter liked his band, and will she be okay with me dating him? Like, those are okay roadblocks, I guess. They're not. But I don't know if there's not enough there to build a movie on.
Well, and they were, and one of the roadblocks, quote unquote, that they were talking about was, you know, oh, the daughter's having such a hard time with it. She wasn't at first.
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, like,
she was, until she got it at school. She was like, oh, hi, you know. This was like, I don't know. I think that maybe they should have tried her with some of the different band members and. Dakota Aiden was hot. Maybe he should have. He had personality.
That was another roadblock where, like, the band, like, tells on him, essentially, like, oh, yeah, this is how he picks up older women. He dedicates songs to them at our concerts.
Yeah. But it would have been funny to me if, like, instead of her, you know, her first love was the husband, if she'd been a total slut like him and just said, yeah, I fucked like 15 different guys before I was 20, before I was his age. What's the big deal? You know, like turn all the like negatives into, you know, positives for the plot. Just like, so she's like, I don't care. And then he has a problem with it. You know, like Dante and Clerks, you suck 37 dicks. Like, I'm leaving. Try not to suck any dicks on the way up to the parking lot. Best comedy line ever.
Oh, it's so great. It's so great.
But you know, if it had been like her being more, I mean, it is 2024.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't seem like she had any agency that most women in the 90s had in movies.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't have that. Yeah. So what? I'm dating, you know, he's 24. Who cares? Let me have fun. I don't know.
Yeah, just make a decision to enjoy yourself. Like, what is the, what was the big obstacle? Like, oh man, I'm having way too much fun and great sex. This needs to stop.
Right. That was when she was like, I can't do this anymore. And I'm like, in a car? Wait, you're, cause let me tell you, if you're not driving a stick, you can be driving a stick. No, it's just, it's like, yeah, she, the only obstacles were in her head.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I mean, okay, now he's not super famous, but Danny Motor, who is married to Julia Roberts, they do fine. You know, they don't, they're not in the spotlight constantly or anything, but you know, he's just a normal guy and she's Julia Roberts and they have been together for 20 years. And it's like, it can work if you want it to work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just one of those movie plot devices, kind of roadblocks.
So here's a funny scenario for you. What is your version of this with your mom and someone she could date that would then enter your life and go, my mom's dating this person who's older than her that is a celebrity?
Or that she's older than, but like I was into, my mom wasn't exactly adventurous. I guess for me, it would have to be somebody from like Duran Duran at the time or Culture Club. You know, if she dated Boy George, I'd have been like, what the fuck is going on? He's gay, mom. But, yeah, I mean, if she dated like Eric Estrada, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think of my teenage crushes.
Yeah, this would be like if my mom dated Tony Danza. I think, yeah.
I'd try to get him to stay over that so tracks. I could see him make it.
That tracks. All right, let's talk about the big movie of the week, The Fall Guy. And Jeff, this one has been in the news today on social media because people are talking about a lot of people asked, you know, hey, why didn't people go see this movie that a lot of people seemed to like and got relatively okay reviews? And a lot of angry people responded because they can't afford to go to the movies these days because of, you know, money.
And, the death of cinema again.
And it's like, I like this movie. All I did was recommend it. And I got people telling me, I can't afford to go to the movies. Sorry. Okay. Then don't go to the movies. I'm sorry if you can't afford to go to the movies. I don't know. I don't pay to go to the movies. I'm a film critic. I just recommend movies.
Mm-hmm. You and I have had this conversation. Right now, I'm underemployed and people need to buy more art so I can go to more movies. But yeah, it's like, it's tough to, you know, go see several movies a week. I've got to figure out a way to become a critic so that I can go see them for free too. But maybe we should have one of the cinemas in town sponsor us. but yeah, I mean, I get that. I get that it's, it is expensive to go to the movies, especially if you want to take snacks or if you want to get snacks or whatever. I was carrying my backpack just in case I want to get snacks and, you know, not have to carry my phone. That's the reason I carry my backpack. but I don't think that is what everybody is talking like this. According to the internet, this movie has underperformed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the fact that it's expensive to go to the movies is the only reason. I also think that maybe it's the fact that it's a 40-year-old IP that people our age who are alive and actively watching TV when the show that the movie was supposedly based on came out were scrambling for a movie about the Fall Guy. That being said, from what I remember, this movie is nothing like that. You know, it's just, it's not that formulaic. I mean, it's a little formulaic, but not that kind of formulaic, episodic TV kind of formulaic.
it's almost a coincidence, honestly. I know it is based off of the TV show, but because they do share the title, and he did apparently fight crime, and this movie is adjacent to that, I guess. But this is basically more like, it's a very vague connection. You could have this movie in it and have nothing to do with the Lee Majors TV show. The premise of
it
the
could fall have been called Thumbs Up.
Yeah. The premise of the Fall Guy is that Ryan Gosling is one of the world's great stuntmen. He's on a job. He's flirting with the camera operator played by Emily Blunt, and they're planning to go out and spend some time together and dating and whatnot. And he has this accident where he does a fall and he hits the ground and he breaks his back and he's out of the business. So he spends some time away, 8 or 9 months recovering and parking cars and generally not being in the business until he gets a call from a producer, Hannah Waddingham, who's fantastic in this movie. And she calls him and says, "Hey, I need you in Australia to be in this movie." He's long time been the stuntman for this guy named Tom, played by Aaron Taylor Johnson. And this guy's making a movie in Australia, and she needs, Colt Seaver to come down there and be his stuntman again. But also she's got an ulterior motive because Tom, the movie star, has gone missing and she needs him to go and find him. It happens to be that this is Emily Blunt's first movie that she's working on as a director. So he's got motivation to want to be there and also want to help her save her movie. And that's essentially what plays out, is that he helps out on the stunts and is filling in for Tom as essentially his stand-in in the movie. And he's also spending his time trying to find Tom. And I found every bit of this to be completely charming because Ryan Gosling is having a great time. Emily Blunt's having a great time. They've got, unlike Anne Hathaway and Nicholas Galitzin, these two people have incredible chemistry. They're kind of explosive together, and their scenes together are wonderful. They're just filled with these, charming back and forth. They've got a tremendous, flirtation that's witty. They've got just a amazing chemistry where they're bouncing off of each other with jokes. And I just loved every scene they're in. And then the action is spectacular. It's these tremendous, like, stunt scenes. David Leitch, the director, co-directed the first John Wick. He's directed Atomic Blonde with Charlize Theron and Bullet Train. And I mean, he's just done some incredible stuff. And he's really great at practical stunts. And the stunt work here is awesome. I had a great time. And Winston Duke plays one of the stuntmen. He's great in this movie. I kind of saw like the whole plot, the way it was going to play out, the way, how it was going to, it's not an overly smartly plotted film, but it doesn't need to be because it's getting by on charm. And I think part of the issue that this isn't like a brilliant movie. It's just a really fun movie. David Leitch is not somebody who directs, rom-coms. There's a lot of rom-com kind of adjacent stuff going on here. He's a guy who likes to direct stunts. And he's leaving the fun stuff to Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt. And I don't think he knows quite how to pace those romance scenes and find a way to reach the point where they end. He doesn't know quite how to do that. That's not his specialty. His specialty is action and stunts. And sometimes that can work. And I thought it worked here. I thought it worked well enough because the action and the stunts and these two characters are so fun. I didn't mind the occasional time where he's lingering too long on these scenes.
Yeah, I thought like kind of the same thing. As I was watching this, I kept feeling like all the romantic stuff was almost improv.
Mm-hmm.
And all the stunt stuff was like directed to the second. You know what I mean? Just the chemistry between Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt is great. I'm not Ryan Gosling never has really done it for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked him in this. I think that, his, ever since he was Ken last year in Barbie, I think that he's kind of been able to do kind of his own thing a little more.
Yeah. Like, how is this the guy from Blue Valentine and The Place Beyond the Pines and Only God Forgives? Yeah. Like, it's a complete 180. And it's amazing to watch. Just the range that he has is incredible.
Yeah. I think Barbie really let the goof out Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of, he's leaning into that just in his personal life and in this movie. Emily Blunt could read the phone book and I would want to watch it, or sign the phone book if she's doing another Quiet Place movie. You know, she's just, I just love her. I've loved her since The Devil Wears Prada. You know, here we go again. But and her singing Against All Odds.
Ah, fantastic.
Perfection.
Gorgeous. Perfection. Absolutely great, great scene. And cutting between that and the big stunt scene that they're doing is just superb stuff. And you're like, you're kind of, you're rooting for him to get there to finish the action scene and get to the bar where she's singing so they can have their romantic moment. It's like such a great, it's such a great sequence. And I think for Emily Blunt, she just refuses to do typical romance. She's got to bring something else to it. I think she has the kind of mind that gets bored by the tropes, and so she refuses to do them. And that's why her energy in movies like this is so different than everybody else's. Like with that movie she made with The Rock based on the Disney ride, I can't even remember the title of, she refused to do Jungle Cruise. She refused to do the typical stuff. She always does. Yeah. She's always doing, and you can tell that The Rock was not prepared at all for somebody to go off the script as much she did as she did.
But could you imagine her in that Anne Hathaway movie?
Right? She would never go for that. She would never go for just a basic scene. She would make that, she would be fascinated. She would like think of the turtle scene and she'd go, tell me more about the turtle. I want to hear more about your turtle.
Right.
To the point where he gets up and walks away.
Two things also about this movie. Stephanie Hsu was completely wasted.
Yeah, unfortunately.
She's one of my favorites, and her, you know, one real scene in the movie was nothing. I sat there trying to think, is Tom Ryder supposed to be Tom Cruise? And then I was like, at the end when he's getting up and he's doing his speech as the space cowboy, I'm like, oh, he's Matthew McConaughey, because Aaron Taylor Johnson's Matthew McConaughey impression in that last scene was all right. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was just, I'm like, oh God, this is just absolutely McConaughey.
Aaron Taylor Johnson is low key the MVP of this movie. The choices that he makes, the performance is just, it's just not anything that you're expecting.
Well, and honestly, he's not in the movie there that much. But when he is, he's like, it's like he's wrestling the scene out of Ryan Gosling's hands so that he can eat it.
But it works. It does work. It does. This movie's really funny. Like, there are just so many big laughs in this movie. There's a moment where just Ryan Gosling is listening earnestly to Taylor Swift that just had me just giggling endlessly.
Yeah, I gotta wonder if it's the 10-minute version of that song or if it's just the regular version of that song. I'm guessing probably the 10-minute version based on where he is in his life.
That's so great. It's so great. There's just so much fun. I can nitpick and take apart pieces of this, and I don't want to because I just had too much fun watching it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've said this before, I'm not somebody who their first choice is going to be a comedy, but I like comedies like this that are a little irreverent and they don't take the comedy as seriously. It's more of a, you know, like kind of putting two people in a room together and see what they can do. So
yeah, you would want to be like, this movie is evidence that you'd want to be at a party where Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt are there.
Yeah.
That's such a good, like, this is, it's that old thing about you, this is who you'd want to have a beer with. You'd want to have a beer with Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling.
Oh, I can imagine scenarios where I'm just sitting there talking to Emily Blunt for 2 hours and John Krasinski's off to the side would be like, dude, and I'd be like, don't worry about it. I'm not interested in that way. So
yeah, highly recommend. If you can't afford to go to the movies, go see The Fall Guy. I recommend it. If you can't afford to go to the movies, I understand the economy's tough right now. you know, wait for it to be on demand and watch it then. This does not have to be the movie that we have this discussion about. This is not the economic crucible.
You know what, though? This is where I started to think about it a little bit today, because I was, cinema's dead, cinema's dead. The movie theaters are all going to go down in flames right now. No. And yes, this is why, and we've had this discussion last year, this is why we need the summer blockbusters, so that everybody, goes to the movies. This is why we need horror movies, because that's what draws everybody into. Again, this is a movie based on an IP that our fathers watched, and our fathers are dead. It's not, it marketed to those people who were alive 40 years ago watching the original. It's not the way to go. It shouldn't have been called The Fall Guy, because I think everybody's like, why are they remaking a show from 40 years ago? No, it completely elevated from that. And it's completely worth seeing. If for nothing else, the chemistry between the two leads.
Absolutely. And here's what I don't get, is that everybody's going to be singing a completely different tune. When Planet of the Apes goes over $60 or $70 million this weekend, nobody's going to say people can't afford to go to the movies. Mm-hmm. maybe people are saving their money to go see Planet of the Apes, and that's why The Fall Guy didn't open big. I don't know. Yeah. There was somebody else, though, who pointed out, like, the poster for The Fall Guy called it, a blockbuster. And it's like, no, it wasn't. It wasn't a blockbuster. Well, who plans to not make a blockbuster? Yeah. Really, this is the marketing hill you're going to die on. Is like, they said it was going to be a blockbuster and it's not. No, we got you.
This is one of those movies. If we didn't live in a system that everything has to make $1 billion, it's opening weekend or it's a flop. Mm-hmm. This movie is one that would play for, 3 months. Maybe it's just on one screen after the last couple weeks, but it's one of those ones that word of mouth. Somebody asked what I saw yesterday, and because I said I'd gone to the movies, and they're like, oh, what'd you see? The Fall Guy. Oh, I really want to see that. Is it worth seeing? I said, yeah, it's completely worth seeing. Oh, I'm going to make a plan to go see that this week.
It's fun. That's a fun movie.
I also loved the post-it notes. First of all, Hannah Waddingham's line, oh god, it's memento level at this point.
I laughed. Fucking great. That.
And then some of them, like one of them was buy unicorn food, which means that he was seeing the unicorn that Ryan Gosling was seeing. It was just a nice touch.
Yeah, some terrific little comedy beats. I also have to praise the trailer for this movie. There's so many trailers in this modern age where they give away the entire movie, like Abigail ruined their entire movie with their trailer. Yeah. This trailer for this movie has so many jokes that are not in the movie. They built the trailer out of jokes that aren't even in the movie.
Yeah. Like, and the kick his ass was said in the trailer 3 or 4 times instead of just the twice that it was here. Oh.
Yeah, it's great. There's so many alternate cuts from that trailer, and I really was impressed that they found they had so much material that they made the entire trailer out of jokes that aren't even in the movie. That's great. All right, let's get on to a conversation about our classic this week, which is always a controversial topic, Star Wars. Specifically Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, 25 years ago, this movie came out, and it's one of the most vivid memories of my life, Jeff, is seeing this movie. I got to see the midnight show, the very first midnight show at our local theater. There were people in costume everywhere. It's the most packed I've ever seen our local theater, which has 18 screens. I believe 13 of them were showing Star Wars that night. And there were people with lightsabers doing demonstrations before the movie down the floor in front of the screen. It was amazing, and the energy in that room was just unlike anything I've experienced outside of like I've talked about my experience watching Signs. Like, that's the only thing I can compare it to, just a group of people who are all on the same page looking up at something and just being in awe of it. And that's what's so weird about this experience of watching this movie again is, like, I remember walking out of that theater absolutely loving The Phantom Menace, and I didn't hate The Phantom Menace until like 4 years later.
What? You're kidding me. Everybody hated it from the moment it was on the screen.
Like, I can look at it, like, even in 1999, I did see, like, when I do see, like, the trade designation, and when I see that, I just kind of nod off a little bit when we start talking about that. But that is not nearly as big a part of the movie as people make it out to be. Because I watched it again today, and I was so amazed by how not terrible this movie is. This is not that bad, you guys. People make this out to be the death of Star Wars. This is the worst one. No, Rise of Skywalker is probably the worst one, but
it's The Empire Strikes Back. I'm kidding.
This is really not that bad. The idea, you know, we've got Jedi's and a trade war and a little boy who's going to become Darth Vader. You've got Queen Amidala, who's going to be the mother of Leia and Luke. And they're all kind of introduced in this movie that is about, you know, the rise of the Empire, the rise of this, you know, pseudo fascist government that's going to take over the galaxy, and the people who are going to eventually, after they figure out what's going on, 3 or 4 movies down the road, will figure out and start fighting back against the Empire. But what really struck me this time watching this was that I remember so many people hating Jake Lloyd, that little kid. I really like him now. I watched this movie, Jeff, and I was shocked by how much I liked this little kid and his energy and his excitement.
Yeah.
He is dazzled by everything around him and is just so excited to be part of things. And I actually, like, the kid energy of that is so much fun, watching him, you know, discover himself and discover this whole new world and show off his what little talents that he has that may or may not be related to being a Jedi. And he's having a great time. He's the only one really with any kind of real energy, because, of course, George Lucas doesn't know how to direct actors. He doesn't like actors. He doesn't want to have to deal with actors. He just wants to play around with his toys, and actors kind of get in the way of his toys. so he doesn't give them any kind of thing to do and has them all delivering these very flat line readings for the most part. Meanwhile, Jake Lloyd is being a little kid, and that stands out. That stands out in a movie that is kind of at times lacking for energy. I can see the things that are wrong with this movie. Like, the Gungans, and specifically Jar Jar, are just not needed. There's no necessity. You could create characters that they're such kid pandering characters. They're so goofy, and, like, you know, you've got Jar Jar doing fart humor and they talk funny, and you can just tell that's for, like, 8-year-olds, 7-year-olds that are just, you're just pandering. You're not even taking them seriously. You're just pandering to them. You could make those characters a little bit more, I don't know, a little bit aged up just a little bit, where they don't have to, or whatever the fuck that guy's doing for no good fucking reason. All right.
Boss Nastas.
You can get rid of the stupid patois and have those characters be a little bit more interesting. So that is an issue that this movie struggles with, but it's not nearly as bad as people make it out to be. On top of which, like, you've got some of the best action, Star Wars style action in any of the movies. I mean, the pod race is fantastic. The lightsaber battle with Darth Maul is amazing. What a great piece of, you know, choreography that is. Liam Neeson is delivering. I mean, he's struggling with that dialogue like everybody else, but at the same time, you can sense he's Liam Neeson. He has this, you know, presence. He seems to care about this. He invests in this character. And I think Qui-Gon is a great piece of Star Wars lore to have at the foundation of this story. So I actually was surprised. I did come away liking this a lot more. I can see problems with it. I can still see, like, that flat line delivery that he has everyone doing that does stand out, but it's not nearly as bad as people make out the Phantom Menace to be.
Carrie Fisher used to tell a story that Harrison Ford famously said to George Lucas as they were trying to get through the original Star Wars, "You know, George, you can write this shit, but you can't say it." And George Lucas created one of my favorite things in the world ever, and that's Star Wars. You can see behind me, Sean. Mm-hmm. but he is not a dialogue writer and he's not an editor.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I really notice in all of the movies. Especially the prequels, because he didn't have anybody else directing. He did have Carrie Fisher punch up a little bit of the dialogue, and that you can kind of tell in the prequel trilogy where that happens. But that's the main problem I have with the prequel trilogy, is his insistence that anything that he has in his mind has to be expressed on the screen.
Yeah.
The fact that in the original trilogy, anybody who was bad just had a British accent. Now, if they're a kind of a slimy, money-grubbing creature, they have what could be, like an Italian Jew accent is how it was described to me 25 years ago. And I was like, oh, okay. All right. The Trade Federation guys have weirdly Chinese accents. That's where George Lucas kind of fumbles for me.
Mm-hmm.
His world building is top tier. I don't even hate Jar Jar. Obviously, I've made several Jar Jar artworks that have gone over really well, so I know I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Sexy Jar Jar, especially.
No.
But yes, on the big screen, Jar Jar is more annoying than on the small screen.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, though, like you said, with Jake Lloyd, he's having fun. He's like, wow, I get to do this. And a lot of people, people were so terrible to that kid, calling him Mannequin Skywalker. Anything that they had a problem with him can really be boiled down to George Lucas.
Absolutely. He's a child. He's what? How old is he in this? He's like 7?
I think he was 9.
9? He's like, he's
8 or 9, yeah.
He's way too young to be criticized for his acting.
Yeah. I thought he did fine. He was great.
For a 9-year-old, like, he's spectacular.
Are you an angel? Well, yeah, that's a dumb lie. That's not a kid. That's not the kid's fault. And everybody's like, oh, well, they bullied him so much that he, had a mental breakdown. No, he has, he's schizophrenic, and that just happens when you're late teens, early 20s. That's not because he was
mm-hmm.
bullied from the movie. So I don't like to lay that on, on the hate that he got from this. And it was mostly kept from him, according to his mom. They didn't, they showed him the good stuff. They didn't show him the bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he is kind of like, character wise, he's the best one.
Absolutely.
In the movie. Everybody's like, it's a little weird that, she's such an older woman to him. Isn't that kind of pedo-y? And I'm like, okay, in the movie, she's 14 and he's 9. So it's,
Yeah.
And they don't do anything in this movie.
No, there's no.
They're not
no.
like, making out and talking about sand. That's the next one. And he's just genuinely interested in her as a person because he's never seen anybody like her. The scenes with him and his mom,
mm-hmm.
where he's like, I don't know if I want to go. And she knows that in order for him to get a better life, he has to leave. And Prunella August, who plays Shmi, is just the look on her face as he's leaving. I never really paid attention to it because I haven't seen the movie in theaters since the 3D version of it 10 or 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It is heartbreaking. She's just so like, She just wants this for him. And she knows that she'll never see him again. She does, but that's another,
right?
You know, a sequel thing. But that, I, everybody who hates on this movie because it's the taxation of trade routes and whatever, that's the kind of stuff that the Jedi dealt with. So I guess, you know, that's just.
Well, it's also like it's the first of a trilogy, and they're laying groundwork for what is really going on, which is a corrupt fascist government is on the rise and trying to, you know, flex its muscles. And this is the first, you know, misdirection trying to get around this group of superheroes that are the Jedi. They have got to come up with a plan to hide their evil plan to get around them and also manipulate them. Which I think is, you know, established well enough throughout this trilogy of movies. For all the problems that people have with it, it's Palpatine is masterminding this thing from this moment and throughout the rest. And you kind of have to give a little bit of leeway for the full story to play out, because some of the seeds that are planted here are paid off in the other two movies. Yes, the idea of trade routes and embargoes or whatever the fuck, and congressional whatever, Senate whatever, can be kind of boring. But it's not nearly as long as people make it out to be. The pod race is way longer, you know.
I remember somebody describing this years ago as C-SPAN, Star Wars C-SPAN, and I was like, you have got to be fucking kidding me. The Senate scenes are not long, and it just sets up other stuff throughout the movie. It's not C-SPAN.
The castle siege at the end is terrific. It's incredibly well played. I love that they get to show how smart Natalie Portman is. She's not only, she's 14 years old, but she's also like the queen of this planet, and she's a kind of a smart planner. She's bold. She surprises Palpatine with her boldness, with her willingness to risk her own life and the lives of others to take back her castle. And in the end, she pulls off a move that the Jedi don't even know she's pulling off to take the castle. And I loved that. That was fantastic. What a great piece of, you know, establishing how smart that character is, especially going forward, as important as she is. But I also loved that moment for Jake Lloyd when he's in the plane that he's in, the ship that he's in. I loved that for him, that he didn't know he was blowing up that entire place and taking out all of the robots. He had no idea he was doing that. He's just completely just excited to be here and doing this thing, and he happens to save the entire thing. That was great. That just felt like something that a little kid would absolutely, especially one with his kind of adventurous nature based off of, again, well-established in the pod race, this kid would do this. This makes sense for this kid to do this. It's not beyond his capabilities to do this. He's risked his entire life as a slave. He's been risking his life in these pod races. It makes sense that this would happen. Plus, it's an autopilot that's taking him to this plot. To this part of the plot. He didn't fly the plane. It's an autopilot that's taking him there. And then he's just having to do the rest instinctually.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense. And it's, and again, layered in earlier via the pod race scene. It's like, there are things happening here in this script. As bad as the dialogue is, Lucas is using the tools of screenwriting to tell you about these characters and reveal them through their action incredibly well.
Yeah, so this is going to kind of get into the fandom talk I was talking about earlier. Now that this has been re-released and people are seeing it in the theater again, and I've seen a couple things where people were like, you know, Rey is not Anakin Skywalker. Look what he was able to do at 9 years old. And people are like, well, he's a Mary Sue, because he wished, you know, he shouldn't have been able to do any of the stuff that he was doing at 9 years old because he wasn't trained. And then people are like, no, not like that. I'm like, no, that's exactly what you're saying. And the fandom is so toxic now that they think that that's some sort of argument for why the sequels suck, but the prequels were the most brilliant things to ever come out. And I'm like, dude, I'm old enough to remember George Lucas raped my childhood. You know, the guy on the internet who kept just saying that, and like, it became a thing. And then they made a movie called The People versus George Lucas about how terrible the prequels were.
Mm-hmm.
He literally sold them because he was sick of being called a hack and everybody telling him how he couldn't do anything right. That's, you know, so no, this whole fandom thing of, no, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to shit on the prequels anymore. It's all revisionist history.
Oh, so true. So true. I mean, and like I said, a lot of the people who came to hate The Phantom Menace were there that first night just as excited as everybody else, mm-hmm. and left the theater just as excited as everybody else.
Oh, I waited in line all day for that movie. I with friends, and we had the absolute best time. Everybody left that movie thinking, oh my God, this was so much fun. Did you see Darth Maul? Blah, blah, blah. You know, and it's like, I had a great time. I watched this movie 3 times in the theater, the original run, and then got a hold of a bootleg of it and watched it 100 times at home, especially that, the lightsaber fight at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Qui-Gon, great death. It's a fucking great death. It also, again, there's another great scene where you're underlying the capabilities of Obi-Wan, who steps in and gets, you know, and kills Darth Maul. You're showing him as this capable person who will grow into the Obi-Wan Kenobi that we come to know in the other movies. Like, there's layers to this. There really are, mm-hmm. that he doesn't get credit for, because again, a lot of the special effects maybe haven't aged well, and there were maybe too much of that. There's an over-reliance on blue screen technology at the time. And yes, granted. And yes, I could do away entirely with the Gungans and Jar Jar. Yes, I don't disagree with that argument, but so much of this is so good. Like, the embellishment of John Williams' score with that choir is spectacular, mm-hmm. to the point where it's almost better than the original. Like, it is so rousing and so exciting in that castle siege, that when that choir is kicking in wow, really fucking awesome, honestly.
Yep.
And Natalie Portman's great. You know, give her some of Carrie Fisher's dialogue, and I think this is probably a lot better movie, and it's a lot better remembered.
Yeah, I think you're right.
All right, well, we're gonna get skewered, so let's prepare ourselves for the hate mail. And
I'm still on Twitter. I've gotten plenty of hate for liking this.
Yeah, I like The Phantom Menace. There you go. That's the headline for the podcast. I like The Phantom Menace. I still hate Jar Jar. I still wish Jar Jar would go away. Nothing against Ahmed Best personally. He's doing his job. I just don't think it's a good creation. The Gungans in general are just not a good creation. And that part of it I could do without. But so much else of this movie. Jake Lloyd, wherever you are fantastic in this. You know, that is the truth that people need to see coming out of this, is that Jake Lloyd was great in this movie and did not deserve any of the hatred that he got.
Yep.
All right, Jeff, next week we're talking about Planet of the Apes movies.
Awesome.
Have you seen any of the Planet of the Apes movies?
I've seen all of them. I own all of them.
Oh, all right. Cool.
I think we should talk about specifically the Tim Burton one.
Okay.
With Helena Bonham Carter. I'm just kidding.
We'll spend the entire hour on that one. All right, Jeff. Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Have a good night.